Good evening, everyone. You have tuned in to Paradigm Shifters. And what is Paradigm Shifter? It's somebody who's making a difference on the planet in the collective of human consciousness at this time in history. And today we have a very special Paradigm Shifter from Bellingham, my hometown, Dr. Wayne Topping. And Dr. Wayne Topping's subject is really kinesiology, which is using the body energies to, what would you say, heal and assess and really understand what's making us work. So good afternoon, Dr. Topping.
Well, thank you, Veronica. I'm pleased to be here.
I'm glad you're here. And also, so we'd like to know a little bit about your history, what it is you do, and what kind of history has got you to do that. Did you start off wanting to be a kinesiologist?
No. In fact, I knew nothing about kinesiology. I'm originally from New Zealand.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved climbing volcanoes when I was very young, so studied geology. By the time I went to university, I'd already read third-year geology textbooks.
Oh, my.
I was going to go into forestry, but I did very, very well in geology exams, so got steered in a different direction, did a PhD in geology. So I was working on active and dormant volcanoes.
Hmm.
When I first came to the United States, I looked around and found a job teaching geology. I was in Southern California in Pasadena,
mm-hmm.
then up to Eugene, Oregon, at the University of Oregon. Then finally, my final position was in Western Washington University, which is
here.
In Bellingham.
Oh, great.
Yeah, and of those three areas, I just far enjoyed this one, enjoyed this a lot more than the others, so decided to make this a home base.
Hmm. So geology, I'm just sort of chuckling inside. You're talking about volcanoes, and I'm going, well, actually, you could do a real tie-in between chakras and volcanoes, couldn't you? In the fact that we have to evolve as people, and our energy systems need to keep moving, and sometimes they move really radically, don't they?
That's true, and I teach in 23 countries, including Italy, so I think studying volcanoes allowed me to understand the temperament of the Italians. And
oh, great.
Yeah.
Oh, so how did you jump into kinesiology?
Well, while I was teaching in Pasadena, I accidentally got involved with Touch for Health.
Mm-hmm.
Touch for Health at that time was headquartered in Pasadena. Mm-hmm. Dr. John Thee's clinic was about 3 miles away from where I was living.
Mm-hmm.
And I was real skeptical when I first heard about it because I was scientific. I was trained in the scientific mindset, which meant you don't believe something unless you actually see it. Anyway, I went to a free lecture.
But wait, did you study a lot of like thermal energy and that kind of thing that goes with geology and mountains and volcanoes?
Yes, because I'm from New Zealand where you have a lot of geothermal activity.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked on the active volcanoes in the central part of the North Island. Just north of the volcanoes I worked on, there's a lot of geothermal energy being used commercially.
Of course, you can tell that I'm getting kind of obsessed or fixed by the fact that there is a real metaphor between Mother Earth's energies and ours, isn't it?
Well, that's true. In fact, I used that metaphor. Back in 1990, I put out a book called Quake Busters.
What is it called? Quake Busters?
Quake Busters, How to Diffuse the Earthquakes in Your Mind.
Ah.
And the first half of the book was how the Earth relieves its stress by way of earthquakes. The second half is how we can relieve the stress generated by disasters such as earthquakes.
Excellent. Okay, great.
And I thought that was a novel idea. Ran off 500 copies of the book, and then I looked around for a distributor, and no one was interested. They said, California's not interested in earthquakes these days. So here I had 500 books. So I ran around San Carlos, Redwood City, Los Gatos, all those areas, set up little mini workshops.
Around the Bay Area.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly. Teaching people how to get rid of the stress from the earthquake that it just had in 1989, the Candlestick Park earthquake.
Mm-hmm.
So then got through all 500 books, and now I'm ready to upgrade the book, ready for the next big earthquake.
Well, okay, so I'm going to go back to, it's so fascinating. I could go off in five directions, but I want to take us back to Touch for Health. So
yes.
You got from volcanoes into the human energy system and Touch for Health, right?
Yes, and Touch for Health got me into the holistic health field.
Mm-hmm.
Pasadena was a hotbed for lots of activities. So I went to Bernard Jensen, who was into iridology,
mm-hmm.
belonged to National Health Federation, Cancer Control Society, American Nutrition Society. So the health became a hobby.
Hmm.
And what so often happens, the hobby began to consume more and more time. And finally, when I was teaching up at Western, I got that position out of 200 people that applied for the job.
What was the title of your job?
Well, this was a visiting professorship
okay.
to replace Scott Babcock, who was in New Zealand doing Antarctic research at the time.
Hmm.
Now, there's only one place. 199 people missed out. So you had a glut of geologists in the marketplace because oil was down, mining was down, and I didn't much fancy the idea of having to go to Boston one year, mm-hmm. maybe Chico, California next year, not really having any control as to where I went. Mm-hmm. So I decided if ever I'm going to change career, mm-hmm. now's the time to do it. And I'd already been exposed to Touch for Health. I'd met John Barton, who founded biokinesiology, mm. where he had a lot of nutritional background. I'd done some foot reflexology, had done some massage. So I trained with John Barton full-time for 3 months at the Biokinesiology Institute and decided to settle in Bellingham.
So what did he teach at the Biokinesiology Institute? Was it subtle energy flows in the
yes,
body?
Yes, what really impressed me about John was that he could take muscle testing. And once you found the muscle out of balance, you can balance it with regular foods, mm-hmm. amino acids, cell salts, vibrational medicine like Bach flower remedies, with color, acupressure points, with emotions, physical corrections. Mm-hmm. In fact, you could balance something out maybe using 12 different approaches. And I like that very holistic nature. And so I got deeply involved with that. I had enough anatomy and physiology background to be intrigued by it. Mm-hmm. And so that became my major focus.
Plus, you're also a climber, aren't you?
Yes, I am.
And so you kind of have to keep your physiology tuned. You have to pay attention to that as well.
That's true. Yeah. And geology, I haven't given it all up because there's a particular area in geology that fascinates me called medical geology.
Oh.
Where you're looking at health problems in terms of trace element deficiencies and toxicities.
Hmm.
So, for example, if we look at the United States, all the northern tier of states – we're talking about Minnesota, Michigan,
Washington here.
All those, Washington mm-hmm. as well. Those are the rock type, a lot of it's glacial, which mm-hmm. means it came down out of Canada, and the source material is igneous or metamorphic.
Okay.
Which means it wasn't sedimentary rock, there's no iodine left. So by the time the glaciers have ground this material up, brought it into the United States and dumped it, those soils are deficient iodine. So that was the goiter belt.
And oh, then how 19... interesting.
So places
we were
like
all
Michigan.
Given iodine as children.
Aha, you were.
Yeah.
Yeah, because in Michigan, for example, you'd have about 50% of the population would have goiter problems, which is essentially just where there's not enough iodine in the blood, mm-hmm. so the goiter, the thyroid grows larger in order to more effectively capture what little is there.
Hmm.
And so once they added iodine to the iodized salt, to their salt, to make it iodized salt back in 1926, suddenly all these goiter problems disappear.
Interesting.
But what fascinates me is two things have happened since then. One is a lot of people have been scared away from salt because of a supposed link with high blood pressure. And so a lot of people are no longer getting their major source of iodine. So now we're getting a lot of people with hyperthyroid conditions.
Hmm.
And then as people go more and more towards soy is a goitrogen, which slows down thyroid function as well, which is probably helping push people in that direction. And if you look at an epidemiological map of the United States, what I find is the areas of breast cancer in the United States are essentially the same as the goiter belt. So I think there's a link between
really?
Iodine deficiency and cancer.
And remember, Marin County was always calling itself a terribly breast cancer-prone area.
Yeah. I know there's a lot of breast cancer in Whatcom County here.
No, there is.
And we're also probably the leader in the United States, based on the statistics I could see, in terms of heart disease and cancer. And my suspicion is that's probably a selenium deficiency because we have a selenium deficiency in these soils around here, and selenium is both an antioxidant. It also helps prevent cardiomyopathy, and it's also cancer
preventer. What's cardiomyopathy?
Cardiomyopathy is essentially where the heart gets larger and larger and becomes less efficient as a pump.
Hmm. You know what I was remembering? Because years ago I was really into nutrition and studied a lot more than I do now. But I remember the whole story about pellagra. Remember pellagra was a really terrible mental disease?
Yes, exactly.
And it was a B3, yeah. It was something to do with the corn.
Yeah.
Predominant corn as the grain or something. And it.
And because people had so much corn, they avoided other grains that would have had the B vitamins. Yeah.
Yeah, that was very interesting. So it's kind of like that, eh?
Oh, yeah. And that's one of the things that's happening now, because you get a whole rash of conditions, which I think are nutrient deficiency conditions.
So tell me what that is. Like, for example, I asked you about children earlier and the new children and so on. And you said something pretty interesting to me.
Well, I unfortunately can't remember the author's names, but this book has just become published April 30th of this year, 2008.
Okay.
And the two medical doctors that authored this particular book are saying that right now in the United States, one in every two children is being born with ADD, ADHD, allergies, asthma, or autism.
Hmm.
And what they're contributing to is heavy metal toxicity in some cases, nutrient deficiencies, changes in the environment. And I haven't read the book yet because I've just gotten it from Amazon.com. And I'd suggest that part of it's going to be also environmental changes such as the electromagnetic exposure that we're all having as well.
So there are many people who say that the ADD thing actually has a lot to do with the evolution of our species. What do you think of that?
I think that's a subtle form of denial.
Okay.
I mean, I think you have parents that would love to believe that, but I think a lot of this, I mean, we have schools in the United States and some classrooms where 25% of the kids are on Ritalin.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they don't have Ritalin deficiency. If you don't have enough iron and certain other minerals, then you're not getting the amino acids breaking down and, well, being built up to give you the right sort of neurotransmitters.
Right.
So if you don't get enough adrenaline, well, epinephrine and norepinephrine, it may be because there's not enough iron in the diet, which is a limiting factor. And so what we're doing is giving these kids things like Ritalin, which is amphetamine speed, to speed them up, when in fact we should be looking at the what nutrients are deficient, making sure they have the nutrients taken care of, and I think a lot of this can be solved.
So how can that happen? I mean, for example, you're doing Touch for Health and kinesiology and so on, but it's my experience that it's really difficult to find practitioners who will really pull together a realistic, nutrient support.
Part of the challenge is that a lot of people in the field don't have enough nutritional background.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you do work with nutrition, then you have to be careful that you're not accused of practicing medicine without a license as well.
So it's kind of suppressed in this country.
Yeah, yeah.
And in New Zealand?
New Zealand's a lot more open.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Certain countries are more closed. Switzerland's more closed. Pharmaceutical industry has a lot of power there. And so a lot of the kinesiologists are too afraid to even work with nutrition. And I think it's unfortunate because when I work with clients using muscle testing, I'm using it as a biofeedback tool to identify how the body's out of balance and what's required to bring it back into balance. And while I can use specific minerals and vitamins to find out what the body would like,
mm-hmm.
then my approach is to find out which foods are rich in those nutrients and which of those foods do they want to add into the diet. I'd far rather they have foods because foods will have a lot of cofactors, enzymes, a lot of things science hasn't discovered yet.
Things that kind of interplay together.
Exactly,
mm-hmm.
exactly.
So as a kinesiologist, okay,
yes.
Tell me what happens. You go ahead and do some muscle testing. What does that look like?
Well, what happens is it's a little bit like when people do hypnosis. After the person's had a hypnotic session, the person can ask, well, what was that like? Well, I don't believe I was hypnotized. Because it doesn't believe they're hypnotized.
Right.
So that's why a lot of hypnotherapists will build in convincers
mm-hmm.
to be able to prove to the person after the fact that, in fact, they were hypnotized. And so the muscle testing is a really valuable convincer. I can have the person turn the head to one side, check the muscle. Maybe it's locked. Then they turn the head to the other side, and suddenly the muscle unlocks. That tells me energetically that the person's having difficulty turning the head to that side. Now, they may be aware of it because they might have pain in the neck.
Mm-hmm.
Then I'll get them to unfold the ear just as if they're trying to flatten it out
mm-hmm.
so there's no curled part there. Do that 3 or 4 times up and down.
Like this?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'll have them turn the head to the side again, check the muscle, and now the muscle will be strong. And they'll say, wow, I can turn my head further to that side now.
So when you're unfolding the ear, what's happening inside?
What's happening, you've got about 360 acupuncture points. You've got a lot of reflex points in the ear that
okay.
relate to different organ functions. You've also got reflexes there that relate to each of the chakras,
mm-hmm.
and I use them for that purpose as well. And it also seems that when children are very young, when the mother speaks to the child's natural tendency is to turn toward the mother
mm-hmm.
to match facial expression with what they're hearing. So they're starting to match facial expression with tone of voice, the emotion, that type of thing.
Right.
And so you've got that natural head turn. So there's certain muscles, upper trapezius, levator, scapula, are going to be involved in that head turn. And so the ear has reflexes that seem to be related to that, the turning of the head. So if you look at men, for example, as they get older, a lot of times if they're driving and they look behind them, it's like they swivel the entire upper chest because they've lost a lot of that flexibility in the neck area. Then as they start losing the flexibility in the neck area, you're going to find a lot of times they'll lose the ability to hear certain tonal ranges as well.
So it would be a nice, affectionate, romantic thing to wobble each other's ears on a regular basis.
Exactly. And when kids go off to school, a situation where it's real important that they actually hear what the teacher's saying. What they can do is just unfold both ears.
We say unfold, it's like running your thumb and straightening out where this folds.
As if you're attempting to flatten out the ear so there's no little curved part there.
Wow, that's
go
kind
from
of
the
neat
top down
trick.
The bottom. And in fact, what they could do is imagine they're in that classroom situation listening to that particular teacher's voice, because sometimes certain voices can switch off our ability to hear. And so when you're thinking about that individual unfolding the ears, you switch on the brain's ability to stay focused in on that auditory input.
So it'd be a great thing to teach a child.
Oh, yes, ideal. And at the same time, not only you in improving the ability to hear information, you're improving a lot of the circuitry in the brain that's involved with doing mathematics, doing spelling, recalling what you read yesterday, what you wore yesterday. Those sort of circuits are activated by the same exercise.
Okay, so if we're talking about seniors, for example, people who are losing their memory and so on.
Yeah, that would be extremely valuable just to unfold the ears. Something incredibly simple,
both to improve
the hearing of what's going on in the environment, also allow you to focus in on what a person's saying so that you're not distracted by all the other sounds happening in the environment. Because there are some people at airports are going to have a difficult time listening on the phone because all the background noise just sort of drowns it out. So this can improve your ability to focus. It also improves flexibility. And as we get older, generally we lose flexibility in the neck, particularly in terms of turning the head to one side or another.
Wow, isn't that intriguing? All right, so I want to go a little bit farther. So you're saying that you use muscle testing to assess how people are and what's missing and so on.
Yes.
And there's more than one kind of muscle test. I mean, do you use the arm, the resist, that
yes.
sort of thing?
Well, let's give you a quick history of muscle testing. I can't tell you where it first started, but I know in the 1930s, for example, the medical profession were using it strictly as an assessment tool. So someone's had a stroke, and the obvious question is, what's the extent of the damage? So they'd muscle test different muscles to find out which muscles were functioning, which ones weren't.
They just did it in the hospital?
Yes, exactly.
So you didn't have to be a renegade to do this?
Oh, no. No, it came out of the medical profession.
Wow.
But then in 1964, you had a chiropractor called Dr. George Goodhart.
Okay. And I think I've heard about him.
Yeah, and he was very innovative in lots and lots of different ways, very curious, inquiring mind. So if he was working with a patient and nothing was working, then he'd be looking for exploring to find things that would work. So he stumbled on the fact that different muscles relate to different meridians.
Okay.
So the Chinese talked about 14 major meridians, well, 20 major ones, but in Touch for Health we work with 14 major meridians.
Okay.
So he was able to correlate specific muscle tests with specific meridians, and those meridians feed energy to specific organs. So you have a correlation between specific muscles and specific organs. And that was in the chiropractic field. He was able to get corrections coming out of the osteopathic profession back in the early 1930s, where you'd massage reflex points on the body as a way to get the lymph flowing more effectively out of those muscles, in effect switching the muscles on. You could also hold certain reflex points on the head, a technique that went back to Dr. Terence Bennett in the 30s also. So what George Goodhart put together is a whole model called applied kinesiology, where you test muscles and have a whole series of reflex systems that could be used to balance out the muscles in order to change the posture, in order to change organ function, in order to improve health in general.
You know, it's funny, in all of my life experiences, I don't know that many people who are professionals who use that. I know a lot of alternatives, know, not me, actual professional people.
Well, most of the people using, I was going to say most of the people, but that's not true. A lot of the people using kinesiology professionally are chiropractors.
Okay.
Because to use applied kinesiology, you have to have a license to diagnose.
Okay.
So we're going to find naturopaths, chiropractors, some psychiatrists, doctors, people like that. But the John Thee was a chiropractor in Southern California.
Hmm.
Got exposed to George Goodhart, and over a period of time realized, well, this is not only fascinating material, it can bring about quite profound changes quite rapidly,
mm-hmm.
and it's relatively simple, a lot of it. So he packaged some of it, called it Touch for Health. And this was applied kinesiology packaged in such a way that it could be made available to the layperson.
Hmm.
And he combined it with an energy model. The idea is you test muscles related to different meridians. By balancing out the muscles, you're balancing out the meridian energy flows in the body and getting all the positive results you can get by balancing out the meridian system.
Things of that system would,
yes, exactly.
Would work better. So tell me this. How does it work for psychological stuff? So when you use kinesiology, can you improve people's...
Yes. That's the area I specialize in.
Bipolar. Oh, really?
Yeah, because I love that particular area. I mean, I'll have people...
I'm pretty fascinated by it.
Yeah, I'll give you some examples. I had one person come in, and he had muscle spasming out of control all over his body.
Mm-hmm.
And I found out what had happened. He had an argument with his girlfriend just before she flew out of Seattle for another state. And then soon after she landed, she had a head-on collision with a drunk driver and was killed.
Oh, my.
Well, naturally, he blamed himself because he was saying, well, if I hadn't had the argument, then this accident would not have occurred. I'm the cause of the accident. And so
He's had a lot of grief.
Yes, exactly. So what we did is used a very simple technique called emotional stress release to take that stress out of the session, out of the way. And so by the end of the session, no aches and pains, all the muscle spasm was gone, and that's all it required, just one session.
So we could have said, oh, no, it's such deep trauma, it will take many, many sessions of talk.
Yeah, no, it's not necessary.
Yeah.
Another situation, this woman had come in and she had lost two of her relatives by death. Her grandmother was in the process dying, and so again, lots of aches and pains, and she knew it was all stress-related.
Mm-hmm.
So we came in, in a case like that, I always teach people how you can get rid of the stress on something that's unrelated to the major issues first, so mm-hmm. they can develop rapport. I mean, they can trust me, they can trust the process I'm using, and they can trust that they're going to respond positively to the experience.
So you try it on something kind of simpler.
Yeah, something simpler that's believable from their point of view.
Okay.
Then once we've established that, then we can go in and start working with the real issues that are causing the immediate stress.
Mm-hmm.
And so again, after one session, all the stress is gone, aches and pains absent, things like that. And I thought, well, let's have her come back in. I think it was about 2 weeks' time because grandmother's still in the process of dying. Well, when she came back, grandmother was still lingering, but yet another relative died in the meantime, and she used the techniques we taught her in the session to take care of that stress,
hmm.
so she was fine.
And so what are the techniques?
Well, if you observe what people do when they're under stress,
right.
One of the major things they'll do is put their hand over the forehead.
Okay.
If they're seated, you'll notice that they have the elbow on the table and have the hand propping up the head.
Yes.
That's the physiology of someone under stress. Now, why is that occurring? The reason it's occurring is when you're under emotional stress, the frontal part of the brain shuts off. You revert back to and react out of the reptilian brain, out of the limbic system. That's automatic.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for that is survival. Because if it's a true emergency situation, you do not want to be thinking up of your different options because you're going to use valuable time. You'll get yourself killed in the meantime.
Right. You have to pick something really fast.
Yes. So you want the automatic reflex survival-oriented reaction to occur. Now, these people that put the hand over the forehead, and I've got lots of pictures of Castro of Cuba, Prince Charles, Greenspan, lots of people you'd recognize mm-hmm. with the hand over the forehead. Now, so they're doing it automatically. They're not thinking, I'm under stress, I need to do this. They're just doing it reflexly.
Right.
So if we teach people to do it consciously.
Purposely.
Which means, yeah, purposely. So either with one hand or with the fingers of both hands on the bumps that occur above the eyes.
Mm-hmm.
So if the person that's listening to this were to get the eyebrows, go straight up above the eyes,
okay.
about 2 to 2.5 inches above, you're going to find a couple of little bumps called the frontal eminences.
Okay.
They're slightly eminent points on the frontal bone. And if they were to hold their fingertips over those points lightly while they think of the stressful situation, After a certain period of time, maybe 30 seconds, a minute, 2 minutes at most or so, they'll find the mind will start wandering off onto something else. When they get to the point that the mind wanders off onto something else, that's one of your best evidences that the immediate stress is off that situation. The control of the brain is back in the frontal lobes. So what's happening when you hold these two points physiologically, apparently, is you're pulling the blood supply back into the frontal lobes of the brain. Once the blood supply is back there, you've got the glucose, you've got the oxygen, you've got the fuel available, and that part of the computing system is booted up again.
Excellent. I want to say several things. One is, for example, if people are iodine deficient.
Yes.
Or if children are born with ADHD because of specific deficiencies, can this kind of work improve their metabolism at such a rate that they don't need to be suffering from the deficiency? You know what I'm saying is, like, can the body reorganize and replace something that was missing? Or do you need to have an awful lot of supplements? It seems to me there's an awful lot of supplementation required as well to fix things up.
Well, it depends on the situation. If you have a child that's born with mercury toxicity, maybe the mother...
I was just going to ask you about mercury.
Well, let's say, for example, that the mother, you know, out of ignorance, had mercury amalgams put in during pregnancy. And the fetus developing picked up some of that mercury toxicity. Then it's useful to have something like selenium. Selenium is a trace mineral, but it's a natural chelator for mercury.
Okay.
And it can help pull mercury out.
Oh, selenium is a natural chelator for
Yes.
Okay.
So in areas where you don't have enough selenium in the soil, you could have more multiple sclerosis, so-called, such as
we
have
that around here?
Yeah, in Washington State. Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, some of those areas where you don't have enough selenium and where you might have mercury in the environment from the mines and that, generally you're going to have more multiple sclerosis.
Oh, that's very interesting.
Yeah, because multiple sclerosis, you know, you've got a number of different causes. A lot of it seems to be autoimmune when the body is attacking the myelin sheathing, but some of it seems to have an origin where you've got toxicity that's interfering with the quality of the myelin sheathing. Really,
now, I remember
matter.
Reading that it had a lot to do with the parietal lobes being weakened as well. Is that right?
Well, I don't know about that, but I know if you're born in the tropics and then spend the first few years there and go to the temperate area, you won't get MS. But if you're born in a temperate area, then later go to the tropics, then you could still get MS. And I think part of it is because in the tropics you get a lot more light. More light means more vitamin D. My suspicion is you're getting calcium being taken across the myelin sheathing, stronger bonding in the myelin sheathing. That would be my guess as to what's going on. But we do know that temperate areas you have more MS.
So you can't really replace how you were created. Where am I going with this?
Well, I think what you're saying is if you're born into this world with heavy metal toxicity, yes, you can.
It's a bit of a process.
Yeah. Well, you can, and you don't have to use just selenium. You could use chlorella, cilantro, the natural food substances, elgin, that can help chelate or pull heavy metals out of the body.
And it's very interesting to me that some people are deeply affected by, for example, mercury, and some people don't seem to be bothered at all.
Yes, mercury is a neurotoxin. However, there are some people sensitive to it as well. And that's a little bit like having an intolerance to a food item versus having an allergic reaction. If you have an intolerance, it means you can handle it maybe 3 days out of four, but if you had 4 days in a row, then the body would have a reaction. But if you have an allergic reaction to something, you can have a reaction to the smallest amount of something.
And you can actually, with the work you do, desensitize people from an allergic reaction, right?
Yes, because it's not normal to be allergic to things. So if someone comes in to me and they're allergic to something, that tells me their body is out of balance. I should be able to track down how their body is out of balance and balance it out.
Very often it's an emotional base, isn't it?
Oh, yes.
A reactive base.
Yeah.
As I was thinking about the children, let's go back into that just for a moment. It's kind of a fantastic thing how we're hearing about the indigo children and the crystal children. And, you know, I'm a seer. I see things and so on. And I do see these flashes of light in these children. And there is an awakening going on. Some of them do speak of amazing knowings, which they have no, explainable right to have, you know. But I also see this distress in children, I believe, in the nutritional breakdown as having a huge, huge impact. Can we fix them up? Can we help them pole vault into a higher evolved state?
Yeah, the reason I'd say that is because if you look at ADD, ADHD,
right,
those are essentially American conditions that are spreading,
well,
starting to spread around the world.
They're starting to spread around.
Yeah, if you look at use of Ritalin, which is an amphetamine that speeds up the system, you know, at least 90% of the usage of drugs like this is in America. And I teach in 23 countries. As I go around the world, what I'm finding is that as the American way of eating, with a lot of fast foods, less nutrients in the food supply, the rest of the world is going the same way. The rest of the world is getting fatter, for example, as I won't mention the names, as fast foods go into those cultures.
Mm-hmm.
We see it in Australia, we see it in England, we see it. And if you look at autism, where is it most common? The last figure I heard of in America, it was, I think it's one in every 150 children in the United States right
now.
It's
getting ridiculous, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's just getting ridiculous.
And
so
there's a lot of it in
it?
Australia. There's a lot of it in England.
And do you think it's nutritional, or do you think,
I think it's actually a combination.
Toxicity of metals?
I think it's a combination. I'm a geologist by background, so I go with the canary analogy.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a coal mine, they would have canaries in cages. When the canary flopped off the cage, that was time for the miners to get out. It meant there wasn't enough oxygen to support the canary. Therefore, it's a good, smart, it's wisdom for the miners to get out because they were going to be next. If you look at the human population, where the canaries, they're going to be the very young and the very old.
Mm-hmm.
And what we see is problems affecting the old, Alzheimer's, for example, and we see a lot of problems such as autism, Asperger's, a lot of those spectrum conditions affecting the very young.
Many neurological things as well. I mean, depression
yeah.
and stuff. That isn't the very young necessarily, but depression.
Well, in America, we're putting 18-month-old kids on Prozac and Ritalin.
Oh, my goodness.
That's
that
criminal.
Makes me very upset.
Yeah.
Oh, my. It's sort of hard to know where to jump. I was listening to Donna Eden.
Yes.
You know Donna Eden?
Donna Eden's
stuff?
A good friend of mine.
Oh, really? Well, she just blew my socks off. I interviewed her, but I also went to a talk that she gave and got her books and CDs and so on. And she was talking about a group that she went to, which is seniors who most of them had dementia pretty badly. And after doing energy work and tapping and all that kind of stuff, they were all able to cognitively handle probably their death. I think she said pretty much all of them were on their way out.
Mm-hmm.
And that didn't stop that, but it did help them to leave, like to reconnect before they left and so on. I think that's pretty fascinating. How would you explain that?
I think there's some very simple things that can be done to greatly improve quality of life in the final stages. There's one study, I didn't get a reference to it, but just completed in England, where they decided to put these seniors on to quite a lot of water. And they had all number of conditions resolve themselves, doing nothing else.
Nothing but water.
Yes, exactly. Because as we get older, we become dehydrated.
Mm-hmm.
As we become dehydrated, the body doesn't function as well.
Mm-hmm.
Someone, Don Tolman, attended a lecture. He talked about taking six people with Alzheimer's down to Arizona, brought four of them back free of Alzheimer's. just putting them out in sunlight and drinking in them water, juices, good food supply. Yeah, so I think some of these things
are
reversible.
So you have the regeneration of health, and you also have water, and then you have nutrition, do they?
Yes, and there's some very simple things you could do from a physical perspective, too.
Mm-hmm.
As people get older, one of the things that happens, they often run into knee problems in particular.
Right.
And for a long time, they didn't know what came first. Was it the weakness in the quadricep muscles or the knee problems? They've now decided, this was a study at one of the universities in Iowa, that the problem occurs with the muscles first, and because the quadriceps become weaker, then the kneecap doesn't track as well, so it starts wearing out the joint.
Hmm.
And it'd be very simple to go into senior centers and teach them how they could massage right along the base of the rib cage, which is a neural lymphatic reflex that helps switch on the quadricep muscles.
Yeah, Don Eden talks about that quite a bit, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I know it works. In Eugene, when I was down
there, they let you do it. Sorry I interrupted you, but sometimes I wonder about being able to go in and do that sort of thing.
Well, I'm a massage therapist, so I could if I was invited to. Yeah,
okay.
Not a problem. But what I would like to do is teach people to take self-responsibility and do it for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And I know it works because, for example, in Eugene, when I was down there, I decided to train and run a marathon.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a flat course, a Nike marathon. And my goal was, I, Wayne, am running a marathon on September the 9th in under 3 hours. Started training at the end of January. Up came another marathon May the 6th. And I thought, well, I'm fit enough. I could run this one. So I changed, and the goal began was to run that course. But it was on a hilly course. I trained for flat marathons, so I hadn't done any hills.
Oh, my.
So 6 miles from the end, you had all these hills. I broke down to a walk, and I thought, this is crazy. I've got no energy. I'd hit the wall. Then I suddenly remembered, well, I know what to do. And I just massaged along the base of the rib cage.
Base of the rib cage?
Yeah, okay. Base of the rib cage, switched on the quadricep muscles, and within a minute I was able to break out and run again and finished in 32nd position.
Wow.
In 2 hours 50.
Wow, great.
And so I know that works because I used it under those circumstances.
Now, Wayne, you said something interesting. You said switched on.
Yes.
Okay. So is that just how would you explain that? Is that just like triggering the energy flow so that the muscles are
rejuvenated? Well, what happens, because I'd been running hills right at the end, I wasn't used to it. I must have accumulated a lot of lactic acid in the muscles, and the mm-hmm. muscles said, well, forget this, and they just refused to function. Just the same way as when you have a severe cold or the flu, you have this achiness through the muscles, and you feel very weak.
Right.
Now, the potential muscle strength is still there, but all the toxins are interfering with the effectiveness of the muscle response.
So when you're doing this massage below the rib cage, you're actually
what you're doing is allowing the lymph to take the waste products out of the muscle.
Okay.
And so then the muscle can switch on and perform as it should.
So they're instead of trying to carry out the garbage is gone.
Yes, exactly. And so it makes a big difference. The point is, we could train people to teach seniors how to do this.
Yeah, I like that idea.
And so far fewer of them need to end up with their knee problems, you see.
And memory problems.
Yes.
Tell me about when you talked about using this.
Putting the fingers up on the frontal eminences as a way to get rid of stress. But the first thing I would do is, if the goal is to improve memory, is make sure they're drinking adequate water.
Okay.
Because the one of the major parts of the body that needs water is the brain.
Hmm.
And so when you become dehydrated, the brain is one of the first organs that's going to malfunction, which means confusion, difficulty remembering things.
Mm-hmm.
And so the first thing you need to do is get more water supply, more fluid into that brain.
So many of us believe, or I don't know if I believe it yet, but I know many, many people who do, that you just keep losing memory as you get older. So there's that belief structure running around in our society as well.
Well, there are also a lot of people in their 90s that have very agile, sharp minds right up until the day they die.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd prefer to say, hey, I'd rather join that crowd.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. So any other exercises you can teach us? This, what did you call these? The
frontal eminences. Those
frontal
are the bumps.
Eminences.
Those are the bumps up above the eyes.
Right.
Another one, I mean, there is sometimes under stress, people will get directions confused. They'll mix up lefts and rights.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they can drive around country roads fine, but when they get into a big city with several lanes of traffic, then someone says, well, go up to the next intersection and go to the left, and they want to turn right, because under stress, they're mixing up lefts and rights. Or I see it as a massage therapist. I'll ask a client to lie on their back so I can do the kinesiology, and they'll lie on their front. They'll transpose front and back.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when that's happening, the neurological system of the body is switched.
Hmm.
Things are backwards. And one of the ways to prevent that or to correct it is to put one hand over the navel, run the fingers along the collarbone until you get to the inner end of the collarbone.
Okay.
And so, you know, at the base of the neck, you have a little hollow called the suprasternal notch just above the breastbone.
Okay.
And you find the two ends of the bone there and just drop down immediately underneath and slightly to the outside. You'll find two hollows.
Right.
If you massage those points, those are acupuncture points called kidney 27.
Okay.
The 27th, it's the end point on the kidney meridian. And by stimulating those points, you can help balance out the electrical system, the neurological system, between left and right sides of the body. Because that's when you get switched, most of the time we're going to mix up B's and D's, P's and Q's.
Hmm.
Lots of little kids that are struggling with spelling actually have switching going on in that lateral dimension.
So you would do this even with little children. I'm busily doing my own.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Particularly when kids are in school, it's quite a stressful environment. They're away from home. You got a bit of separation anxiety going on, new learning environment, body in the classroom, things like that. So a lot of them get stressed and switched. And if they massage these points, that can help decrease the chance they'll be switched. So less likelihood that they'll misspell, mishear things. Mm-hmm. And also with the hand over the navel, you can massage below the lower lip mm-hmm. and above the upper lip. This is the end of the central and the end of the governing meridian, respectively.
Okay.
And that helps balance out any neurological problems that might be occurring in the vertical dimension.
Hmm.
Then if the person were to massage right at the base of the tailbone with the other hand over the navel, you also help them to balance out the front back dimension.
Okay.
Because we have three physical dimensions, and you can have this neurological switching occurring in any one, two, or three of those dimensions.
Well, you know something? I was given an article by, I think, Lynn Namka. Do you know her?
No, I don't.
Well, she's from Tucson. But anyway, she was writing that something to do with this kind of thing and switching because of financial difficulties.
Oh, yeah.
Do you want to talk a bit about that? It's pretty interesting, too.
Well, what happens under emotional stress, the body short circuits.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the major things, the frontal part of the brain shuts down. We revert back to and react out of the reptilian brain.
Mm-hmm.
For some people, the left hemisphere of the brain will shut down and they'll go across the right brain, which means big picture, but forget about the details.
Right.
Some people, the right brain will shut down and they go across and left brain, try harder and harder, get more and more absorbed with the detail, but they've
lose
lost
the bigger picture.
They've lost the forest in the meantime.
Yeah, really.
Yeah. But under some people will switch.
Mm-hmm.
So under normal circumstances, they're fine, but put them under emotional stress and suddenly they're mixing up B's and D's, P's and Q's, lefts and rights, that type of thing.
And an ability to handle big picture and small
details. Yes, and it can also be caused by other phenomena too, such as dehydration
uh-huh.
or lack of sleep. I remember one time I'd been teaching in Denmark for 6 days, flew across to London, had a social activity for a day, Saturday night, flew into Ireland, taught Sunday night, Monday night, Tuesday night, Wednesday night. And by Wednesday night, I was saying, stick out your leg, when clearly I meant arm.
Yeah.
And I was transposing leg and arm. Now, there's no simple cure for that because I was massively short on sleep and my body was demonstrating it through switching.
Yeah.
I was transposing different words. And so if people are switched, then it could be dehydration.
Mm-hmm.
It could be around electrical apparatuses, such as computers too much,
mm-hmm.
Lack of sleep, too many sugars in the diet, that type of thing.
Hmm. So let's go back to the financial thing or the left and right hemispheres of the brain being switched. It doesn't really matter, but all of that
right.
would lead to the same thing. Then do you go back into the clavicle, your hands here on the...
Well, what I would do is, if it's a financial stress that's created the switching,
yeah.
I would say the switching is the result. That's the effect. The real causes of financial stress. So put the fingers up on the bumps on the forehead.
On the bumps on the forehead.
And deliberately think about the fact that there's not enough money coming in
mm-hmm.
to take care of all the bills.
So you're thinking about your worry.
Yes, you're worrying. Mm-hmm. I'm giving them permission to worry
okay.
as much as vividly as possible about what's actually going on. And most people think, well, we shouldn't be doing that. Most people have the tendency to try sweeping on the carpets, thinking that's been
dealt with. Because I'm not supposed to look at what's real.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But if you have them deliberately think about it, within 1 or 2 minutes, usually, the mind will get bored and start wandering off onto other things.
Hmm.
That's when you've taken the emotional stress out of the situation. Circumstances haven't changed. I mean, you suddenly don't have a lot more money in the pocket, but the way in which you can handle it has been change significantly.
So you're actually more able to harmonize both sides of the brain.
Yes, and lots of times once you take the emotional stress out, solutions will appear that were there all the time but just weren't seen because of the emotional
blocked.
Stress.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So I wanted to ask you about human potential. For example, a lot of people ask me how to become an intuitive, for mm-hmm. example. I mean, you can use kinesiology for that sort of thing or for being able to run and climb better or for...
Yes, what I would say, if people want to become intuitive with something, do a lot of it. So I've got a friend, for example, works with people with weight problems.
Mm-hmm.
She's worked with over 100,000 people. Well, if you work with 100,000 people, chances are extremely high. You are going to start recognizing patterns because
that's true.
I think a lot of the intuition is recognizing unconsciously patterns because of all the experience you've had. I can tell you with muscle testing.
I think it also comes from trusting your perceptions instead of being...
Well, you have to do that. Otherwise, you'll block the ability to
Yeah, you just be geared by the convention. Huh?
What I can tell you with muscle testing, if I've been doing a lot of kinesiology in a short period of time with people, I'll get to the point where I'll become very intuitive, where I can even sense whether the muscle's going to be locked or unlocked before I even apply the pressure.
Hmm.
But it's only when I've been doing a lot of it. And that's why I know it's intuition. Because I haven't been doing as much of it, then I'm not as keyed in, not as clued in. I'm
so you're saying as a being, then the more we do of something, the more we open up to greater potential.
And as you said, Veronica, trusting the process as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's really interesting. I guess I was looking at, for example, watching Michael Phelps.
Yes.
You know, watching people many years ago in the olden days, I watched the 4-minute mile be broken.
Oh, by Bannister.
Yeah. And it was Bannister and Landy together and all that kind of thing. Yeah.
And no one would be able to break it. And once he broke it, then suddenly you have a whole scatter of people break it in a relatively short period of time.
Then you have human potential shifting collectively, don't you?
Yes, exactly.
I'm really fascinated.
Because it was believed that if the body ran faster than that, it might spontaneously combust or dire circumstances were going to happen, which of course wasn't true. But once a person had broken that, then you can get rid of this particular myth. And suddenly, I mean, John Walker in New Zealand, ran over 100 sub-4-minute miles.
Wow. Well, I can't remember what the number was this time during the Olympics, but it's way less than 4 minutes. It's 3:12 or something.
Yeah, I'm not sure what it is for the mile now.
I can't remember either, except I was watching. I didn't pay that much attention, except I thought, I remember they broke the 4-minute, and look what people are doing right now. I mean, it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, it is.
So when I think of human potential, I just think that we're only tapping a little bit of what we can do and be as people, as healers.
That's true.
You know, even these little children that are afflicted by our diet and so on, some of them are accomplishing a great deal.
Yes.
So I just wondered if you...
Well, I think one of the major things as parents is that we need to encourage and support children as they're growing up.
To break out of the collective instead of do what's conventional all the time, maybe. Do you have children?
Yes. No, I don't. No. Because I think what happens, for example, some little kids can see auras.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you might have parents say, you shouldn't talk about that. You mustn't talk about that. Well, the child's being taught to deny part of their reality.
Suppress yourself. That's the way we get along.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's just like, as I was growing up, we were told, if I was crying, men don't cry.
Right.
And so that was a way to cause little boys to stuff their tears and grow up to be less emotional, more English, that type of thing. And now we
have more therapy.
Well, I guess it fills up lots of rooms and lots of chairs and therapist offices. Yeah. Yeah. But I think what we need to do is validate what children are experiencing and encourage them to grow their full potential without limitation, without limiting them, allowing them to believe that there are lots of things possible. But a lot of parents will say, thinking that they're being helpful and realistic, will say, you can't do that. Do you know how much that would cost?
Mm-hmm.
Well, who's to say that that child might not have the potential to be able to generate the sort of income required to be able to get that?
Well, and going back to something else, and I appreciate what you just said, but I'm thinking about watching little children who are like really loving and very kind of like curious become, say, hardened off, tougher. You know, we've got a lot of very tough teenage kids these days who are not that happy.
Right.
And with your work, I just keep getting the feeling that we can, I don't know if tapping works or what you do, but anyway, help them undo some of that armoring at a very young age. And that's what I think is kind of headed toward human potential, self-esteem, self-presentation. Do you work? You said you work with kids sometimes, eh?
Yes, so I've worked with quite a few kids that have come in with learning difficulties. Mm-hmm. For example, I can remember one locally that I worked with. He had difficulty academically, so that was one session. He also had difficulty with baseball, and so a couple of sessions there. And then later he got a baseball scholarship to go to Whitman College.
Oh, wow.
Straight A's all the way through.
Yay. Isn't that exciting? What about self-esteem or angry kids or that kind of thing?
Self-esteem is going to be based on performance.
Mm-hmm.
Kids that are not performing, that are not achieving, are going to see themselves in a more negative light. And so what we need to do is improve the ability for kids to be able to achieve, to be able to do things, set goals and reach them. And then they'll feel better about themselves as the self-image goes up. Then it becomes not the opposite of a vicious cycle, one that's opening up in the opposite direction.
An unvicious cycle.
Yeah.
An unfoldment cycle.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Because self-image is all based on performance.
Mm-hmm.
If they do well and get good grades, they feel better about themselves. If they do poorly, then they feel worse about themselves, and it's greater tendency to then get into addictive substances to shift their feelings.
That's another thing. What about addictions?
Well, that gets back into the tapping you mentioned, because Roger Callahan, who is the psychologist that really got all the tapping going back in 1985 with his book, 5-Minute Phobia Cure,
mm-hmm.
in one of his books called Why Do I Eat When I'm Not Hungry? His basic premise is, one of the reasons that people eat when they're clearly not hungry is they're using food as a drug to tranquilize their feelings.
Mm-hmm.
So he says underneath that addictive drive is some anxiety. If you have the person focusing on the anxiety while they're tapping on the bony ridge immediately below the eyes.
Right here.
Yes. And what you're doing there, you're tapping on a point called stomach one because the energy is bottled up in the stomach meridian. And when you tap there, it's allowing the energy to be dispersed into the rest of the meridian network. And the anxiety disappears.
Wow. I would talk with you forever, but what we need to do is draw to a close shortly. But I'd like you to mention not only your website, but if you could tell us a little bit about your books and where you're giving classes and what are the classes and what can we people who want to just literally tap into some small part of it start with.
Right. Well, first, my website is www.wellness.com. Kinesiology.com.
Now, kinesiology is K-I-N-E-S?
Yes, I-O-L-O-G-Y.
.com.
That's my website, and that'll tell people where I'm teaching in the world, because I currently
teach in... wellnesskinesiology.com.
Yeah, because
okay.
I currently teach in 23 countries. I'm on the
Not
road
at the
lot.
Same time.
No, no. But
can't even
first,
tap that.
First 6 months of last year, 36 flights, so
wow.
On the road a lot. I do have a number of books out. One of them is Success Over Distress. That's a nice one to start out because it doesn't assume any prior muscle testing background. One website has it listed as one of the top 100 self-help books of all time.
Wow. What is it called again?
It's called Success Over Distress.
Over Distress. Okay.
And it's teaching basics of muscle testing, how people can use the emotional stress release technique. We use one arm to give us feedback from one brain hemisphere, the other arm gives feedback from the other one, so you can find out whether there's incongruence between two different brain hemispheres, the logical versus the emotional brain. So simple techniques people can develop. I do teach a number of workshops. I've got some. The next one's coming up in Bellingham right at the end of October, Stress Release 1, 2, 3, where we're teaching people different simple ways to get rid of stress in general, to identify unconscious blocks that they might
and
not be aware of.
And you're doing that with
of.
Tapping and so on?
The Stress Release 3 gets into tapping. Mm-hmm. We start out with phobias and anxiety, which is the work of Roger Callahan, then expanded into the five-element model that the Chinese developed.
Hmm.
And that then allows us to get into other stuck emotional states. Because certain emotions such as anger, grief, joy, sympathy, fear, all those appropriate emotions. But sometimes they become stuck. When they become stuck, then you have rage, hostility, depression, mournfulness, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And once you identify where the energy is stuck, and muscle testing is the fastest way to do that, then you tap on the ends of specific meridians, free up the energy, and you free up the emotional state at the same time.
Hmm.
We're talking about within minutes.
Hmm. So this is a three-day course that can get people attuned to...
Yes.
Well, I'm,
and my experience is once people take those, then they become hooked. It becomes a healthy addiction. They just become ravenous, want to learn more, because I teach it in such a way it's simple enough they can use it for themselves and then share it with family members and then share it with others.
Mm-hmm.
And a certain number of people I train get so excited they decide to change careers and become kinesiologists to do the same sort of thing I'm doing.
That makes sense. I think it'd be very interesting to work family systems that way.
Oh, yes, exactly.
Boy, oh, boy.
Well, that was John Thee's original idea. He called it Touch for Health. His goal was to have Touch for Health within the family system. So he had one person within every family with the knowledge of being able to do a lot of these simple things so that people can do things for themselves so they weren't as dependent on more foreign approaches such as medications from the outside.
I really like that. Well, this is very exciting, and I'm sorry we have to draw to a close, but I'll certainly be looking at your website, and we can keep track of your schedule, where you are.
Okay, great.
And you're going to be doing this Bellingham one. Bellingham's local for those of us who live in and around the area right now. So that's going to be in October?
Yes, right at the end of October.
At the end of October. Right now, you're currently headed to Japan.
Sunday, I head to Japan. I'm over there for 2.5 weeks, come back, and the following day, head to Italy to speak at a conference, then teach in Switzerland, then another conference in Italy. And
so if people who are in Japan would like to connect with your workshop, they can find the directions on your website?
Well, the best way would be, yes, to email me at wayne@wellnesskinesiology.com.
wayne@wellnesskinesiology.com.
And then I can direct them to the sponsor that I have in Japan.
Excellent. Well, I truly appreciate your visiting us and have really enjoyed this. I'm quite inspired.
Well, this
like
has
to
been
learn
fun, Veronica. Thank you very much.
Well, maybe we'll just do it again.
Sounds great.
Thanks very much.
You're
Dr.
welcome.
Topping.
Take care.
Ooh.